It's time for Mac Break Weekly. Andy, Alex, and Renee are all here. We're going to talk about the latest Apple news, what happened to my Mac Pro, the secret behind the Apple Store, and some inside gossip about Tim Cook. It's all coming up next on Mac Break Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Mac Break Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 392, recorded March 4th, 2014. Mountain Dew and Protein Bars. Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free 2-week trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com. Use the offer code MACBREAK. And by FreshBooks, the simple online accounting solution built for small business owners just like you who want to skip the headache of tax time. For a limited time, try FreshBooks free for 60 days. To get started, visit getfreshbooks.com now and enter Mac Break Weekly in the How Did You Hear About Us section. And by 99 Designs, the world's largest graphic designs marketplace. 99 Designs connects businesses seeking quality, affordable designs with a community of more than 270,000 graphic designers. Visit 99designs.com/MBW to receive a free power pack upgrade valued at $99. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show that covers Apple, all your Apple stories in one concise or somewhat less concise bundle. Joining us in the studio once again, Alex Lindsay, making it a trifecta of Lindsay goodness.
Trifecta.
Welcome back.
It's good to be here.
Nice to have you. You said you weren't going to travel as much, but I didn't believe
you. Didn't believe it. Well, I might be traveling soon again for a little bit. But I've been settling in a little
nice
bit.
Nice to have somebody sitting next to me. Of course, Andy Yannacco's no slouch either. And his monitor is sitting next to me. That's good. From the exactly. Chicago Sun-Times. Welcome, Andy.
Thank you, Leo, and Alex. Again, our hearts have been broken so many times, we didn't dare to believe that you'd be here week after week after week.
And soon it'll be like, when will he ever leave?
Yeah. Alex, don't you have a road trip you need to get to?
Don't you have to go somewhere where you don't have a connection? And
I want to thank Alex because you saved the day on Sunday.
It was great.
Terry Kay is pointing out we had Skype trouble with Film Girl. I think Christina Warren really wanted to go watch the Oscars. Because she tweeted quite a bit from the Oscars.
Yep, there you go.
But somehow Skype got in. No, Christine wanted to be here, but thank you for filling in.
I had a great time.
We got you out in time to watch the Oscars.
I had a great time.
Yeah. And then finally, Mr. Renee Ritchie from iMore.com and Mobile Nations. Good to see you, Renee.
Thank you, Leo. Good to see you, too.
Renee, you look better every week.
Oh, thank you.
The system keeps on refining.
Is it spring yet in Montreal?
It's spring break, which means we're all down by the frozen river in our thermal speedos trying to enjoy ourselves.
Only three layers.
I love, what is it, Jimmy Fallon? Where did he do the polar bear dip?
Chicago.
Yeah.
It was actually the first spontaneous expression he's had on television since he took over the Tonight Show, as a matter of fact.
Well, he did wear a suit, which is a little odd. I don't think that's going to keep you warm in icy water.
Well, see, it's a punk move because you might be wearing like a wetsuit underneath it.
If you
got to go shirtless like the guy to his left.
Yeah.
That guy's the pro. That guy is the pro from Dover.
Wow. And Rahm Emanuel is somewhere in there, the mayor of Chicago.
See, he was wearing shorts. Shorts and a t-shirt, I believe.
Uh-huh, see? Suit, you're right. I bet you he has a wetsuit under
he
there.
He has nothing to hide for a politician. Nothing to hide. Jimmy Fallon, he's got that sort of, squirrely look about him that says that I bet that I'm wearing like a polar suit underneath this.
I don't know.
Could be Green Lantern under there.
That looks like there could be shrinkage going on. That's pretty, he looks pretty chilled.
You're right, because he's not that good an actor either. I saw Taxi.
He was in Taxi?
Oh, yeah, he was Taxi.
Jimmy Fallon?
I appreciate that with Queen Latifah, who could be watching anybody else?
But. What Taxi are you talking about?
I don't think he's talking about the show.
Oh, okay.
He's talking about the movie,
right?
Oh, no,
right? The movie.
Not Taxi. I'm thinking Robert De Niro and Taxi Driver. You're not talking about that.
Yeah, I wasn't even thinking about that.
Jodie Foster.
I was thinking
Taxi, the movie. Queen Latifah, Jimmy Fallon.
It's basically part of the halfway house process. When you stop being a Saturday Night Live male cast member, you have to do one movie in which you play like sort of an immature cop. And so this was his transitional to sort of mainstream him back into society where, you know, people are going to be judging him more on his merits as opposed to being able to be sort of mildly amusing for 2.5 minutes, 1 week at a time, 20 weeks out of the year.
Wow.
It's less startling. It's less frightening for them. And, you know, if we can get more of these former SNL cast members out there, they might actually reproduce and not require such warehousing on network television. And so that's really the goal. I mean, it's nice that we're allowing these comedians to survive, but we haven't done our job as caretakers of planet Earth until we've allowed the native population of somewhat funny sketch comedians to reestablish their populations.
Making NBC cry.
There you go.
Officer Washburn is having a bad day.
Oh, that's always funny Officer when the airbag Washburn goes off later.
It's hard to recognize him because he's not giggling and looking into the camera inappropriately.
Fallon, do you?
I'm not overly impressed by him. Again, I respect him. I respect people who are pleased by him. I have sampled the new Tonight Show. It is not a product that I can use in my professional or personal life.
I like him. He's very likable. He's a sweet, likable boy.
He's likable as hell, but do you want someone who's likable or do you want someone who's funny?
Okay.
And
there you go.
I just don't get it. That's all.
When do we cover the Mac news on this show? Is that soon? Is that coming up?
He does have a Mac on his desktop.
Okay, there you go.
He does have Josh on the show, where I haven't watched in a while, but he used to have Josh Topolsky on the show a lot. So
I'm sure that he will get
two points very much in his favor.
Yeah,
again,
yeah.
I'm merely saying that as a consumer of late night product, he does not create a product that I have a use for.
When does Robert De Niro and Jodie Foster, when do they show up in this? Is that later? You talking to me?
So a remake of Taxi Driver, which he's playing with the Peter Boyle role. But we got to get someone else.
You talking to me?
As Travis Bickle, but as opposed to like the other guy who hangs out at the taxi stand.
Well, we cut just at the right time, by the way, on that trailer. Wow. Wow. There was some brief sensuality, I just want to tell you. All right. Let me give you a couple of updates. First of all, Ellen uses an iPhone. Okay, that's very important. You should all understand this.
Oops.
The best-selling iPhone app.
or it's possible that Ellen's people use an iPhone.
No, I think it's Ellen. I think Ellen uses an iPhone.
So maybe it's just maybe a side effect of the business that we're in, because whenever I see product placement, it's like, Roger Rabbit. I see it immediately.
Now, what they claim is that it was not part of the product placement. It wasn't Samsung. It wasn't part of Samsung's deal to get them to use it in the show. The producers thought it would be fun to use in the show, and they used Samsung obviously because they were already a sponsor. But they, according to the producers for the show, they were like, Samsung didn't know it. They were just
Let me tell you what the Wall Street Journal says. The Wall Street Journal says that, first of all, Samsung bought 5 minutes of ad time on the Oscar ceremony.
Which is why they used it.
Estimated $1.8 million for 30 seconds. We're talking a good $20 million.
Just chump change compared to what they got out of this one selfie.
According to the Wall Street Journal, Ellen decided she wanted to do selfies during the show. ABC said, you might want to use a Samsung Galaxy Note 3. Since they just spent $20 million for five minutes of ad time.
Right.
And it was probably more, I would guess more, as many experts say, more impactful than the commercials themselves.
Absolutely.
That you can't miss that big white pleather.
And the big Samsung logo and
stitched leather.
It's part of the corporate branding. Only one phone manufacturer will make a phone that's that tacky. So,
Yeah, I mean, had it been almost any other phone, you wouldn't know it was a Galaxy Note. But that phone,
only one phone maker saw the Mac OS 10.7 redesign of the calendar application. Said, you know what? We do like the fake stitching. As a matter of fact, we like to put that on a real product.
Yeah,
fake leather is underutilized in our market.
But also, the size is kind of a giveaway. That thing is a monster. Yeah. So the first selfie she took was all blurry and yucky. She goes like this.
Thank goodness Bradley Cooper took over. That's all I can say.
Yeah,
there was a whole lot of, if you watch it, there's a whole lot of she wants to have somebody else do it, and Bradley's like, yeah. let me just have that, and we will now turn it to landscape.
Do you think that any of
don't you love Bradley Cooper? He's living the fantasy that all of us have had when we're in a public space and we see someone using a phone camera wrong. Like, give me that.
Yeah, it was fun to watch though. You see him like slowly just go, give it to me.
And immediately go landscape.
Immediately
showing some good taste.
I think he could tell this is gonna be crappy if I don't get a hold of this thing. So
the journal says that Ellen did receive training in the use of the Galaxy Note.
Not much, obviously.
In rehearsal. Well, she's an iPhone user. She immediately went backstage, took back the iPhone and tweeted out that she had met that other hunky guy. You know, the one I'm talking about. I think it's a good picture. Now, here's the question. You see Kevin Spacey in the back, Julia Roberts, Brad Pitt with his mouth wide open. I love Jared Leto. He's kind of photobombing it. Of course, Ellen's sitting in Meryl Streep's lap. So is Jennifer Lawrence. How do you think those celebrities got paid for that? That's a heck of a selfie. Mm.
What I wonder is, do any of those people have promotional contracts with like other makers?
Right.
And were there people like fielding phone numbers that, yeah, you know what? Mitsubishi just paid you $500,000 in Singapore to never be shot by any other selfie camera ever.
That's why Downey Jr. wasn't in there.
By the way, here's the Photoshop. Of course, immediately Redditors go crazy. And
all Spacey, all the time.
That's really all you need. Once you got Kevin Spacey in there, I really think that the iOS 8 should have that as a standard like camera enhancement.
The Spacey?
Kevin Spacey eyes button.
I'm amazed Galaxy doesn't have it. After
that would actually be a great hangout thing. You know, they have the little glasses that you just have a Kevin Spacey face that everyone can wear.
Apparently, she gave everyone in her audience. I don't know. Does that mean at the Ellen show she gave them all a Galaxy Note 3?
Need to lug it home with them
for you and for you and for you and you. It's just it's so annoying that when I run these YouTube clips, which are basically ads for Samsung products, that I've got to see a yogurt ad in front of it.
Which isn't really a great thought. Is someone at Samsung not really thinking this all the way out? Is that if you have a segment that you want people to actually watch, the key is to not monetize it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a
crazy
segment,
talk.
What?
So it's because whoever uploaded this thing turned monetization on. That's
oh, on the on the YouTube. I see what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
So, by the way, nice plug. First, let's. I guess Samsung bought some time on Ellen as well.
Right.
So they would donate a dollar every time someone retweeted the photo, and the photo got retweeted two million times
so far.
2.8, I think.
Yeah, it's going up all the time.
But I think there was at some point they said it was
$3 million, she said.
I think they said it was being tweeted 250,000 times a minute for.
I almost retweeted it. I was like, stop.
Well, what's funny is I was going to retweet it. I was like, oh, yeah, that's a great idea. And then as soon as I went there, it was dead.
Yeah.
I mean, Twitter went
offline. Well, that was the other thing she declares triumphantly. We killed Twitter, as if Twitter isn't killed frequently.
Well, like it wasn't as historical as I think she thought it was.
Right.
But it hadn't happened for a long time. I was like, wow, this is
first fail whale in a couple of months.
You had to run, find the fail whale in the closet, get it back up.
Yeah. Anybody got the fail whale slide quick? So they're all getting Samsung Galaxy Note 3.
The problem with television, you have the Academy Awards, you have some of the coolest actors ever in one room, and still the host is saying, hey, everybody, turn off the TV, go to Twitter where the cool pictures
isn't that interesting? Yeah.
But I think that it also, I mean, we're one of the things that I think is really interesting, though, is that I think a lot of people are going to take that as a lesson about how to take a, if you're doing a live event, whether it's online or whether it's on TV, finding some way to connect with that audience and have them actually do something is very powerful. You know, and it gets you a lot of
much better
PR. And I think a lot of people are going to see a lot more of this.
Unskippable. Right. You know, of course, a lot of people watch the Academy Awards live. You can expect more of that kind of programming. That makes it hard to skip. Although I did this, I did what most people or many people do. I started the recording, and then half an hour later, watched it.
Well, no, but I think that the thing is that it's so valuable to be doing stuff that's interacting with the audience, because now it becomes a must have. It's crossing across a couple different social networks. Way,
thanks to the Globe and Mail, who points out that in fact the copyright for the photo belongs to Bradley Cooper because he. Because he takes the photo. He owns the photo.
Oh, that's funny.
Canada's paper of record for a reason, Leo.
They also point out that Liza Minnelli desperately tried to get in the shot, but could not. She was way up in the back. She must have run down. Liza was way in the back.
No, I thought she was right behind.
No, she was right there.
I think she was like one or two. I think she was behind Julia Roberts, I think.
She was part of the Wizard of Oz tribute. Or rather, they cut to a shot of the three surviving children of
So Ellen made a joke about her too, saying "Nice costume, sir." I thought that was a little unkind.
I thought they were going to bring her back on for some reason because only the 12th time in human history a human being has won the EGOT. Because one of the composers of the Frozen song also has won a Tony Award, an Emmy, and a Grammy.
The youngest EGOT yet, 39 years old.
Exactly, and Liza is one of the only other living people who have actually won those things. So you'd think there'd be like hustler backstage for a photo op. I'm sure you could have twisted her arm into getting her picture taken during the Oscars.
Globe and Mail points out that if Ellen wishes to use that image in any other promotional material, she must get Bradley Cooper's help and approval. Written
standard,
approval.
Standard waiver.
He wants photo credit.
Yeah, exactly.
Really, there is Mac news. One more thing, and then we're going to take a break, and then we'll actually come back with some actual content. Although I'm enjoying this.
Promise. I know.
Thank you for solving my problem. Actually, thank you.
What did I solve? Oh, yeah.
So the Mac Pro, just an update on the Mac Pro, which was flaky and weird, and I thought it was just me. You know how you blame, even I blame myself. Oh, I must be doing something wrong. That's why it rebooted 3 times in 3 minutes.
Nope.
Must be me. So I'm unplugging stuff. Maybe I have a bad drive. Maybe something's going on. Fortunately, Alex wanted to benchmark. This is the new Mac Pro, what they call the late 2013 Mac Pro, even though no one saw one until 2014. The late 2013 Mac Pro is late. So Alex wanted to benchmark it.
And I did what I do, which is I don't actually do anything.
Last week
at work.
And you gave it to Keith.
So I was like, I hand it off to someone. Okay. Like, of course, I say on the show, I'm going to benchmark it. And then I hand it off to Keith.
That's
and say,
fine.
I
you have people.
A bunch of stuff.
You have people to do that.
Yeah.
So.
And then I said, but check the USB, you know, do some big read writes and stuff like that. And Keith is very thorough. So
he wasn't able to do anything, right?
Well, Keith sent me this long thing. Like, this is what I did. And this copied the first time. It doesn't copy the second time. This will install. This won't install.
It's kind of up and down.
It was just like, this thing is a big mess.
Yeah. You said it was haunted.
Haunted, yeah.
Then he tried to run diagnostics, couldn't.
Right.
And he had the good sense to pull out one of the RAM modules.
He's wily that way.
Did he get an indicator that there was problems with that RAM?
Keith knows a lot about these things.
He just thought about it and said, you know, maybe this is like bad RAM. And it is, by the way, that is kind of typical of bad RAM. It's weird intermittent stuff.
Because it's accessing that memory and not getting out.
So I don't know if this physical damage on this RAM is germane or not, but there was a visible scuff mark. This is the RAM module. This is an Apple module. It was a BTO, so it came with 3 sticks, 12 gigs, and then as ordered, they put a third, thanks to Ed Ingber, they put
whoever stuck fourth the fourth
stick.
One in.
But this is, can you see that the little scuff there?
Yeah.
And if you, that first of all, that shouldn't be there. It's like somebody stepped on it at the factory. And then Burke thinks that there's damage to a couple of these traces right here. And maybe up here, too. You see that they got smooshed. That clearly got smooshed.
Yep.
So I had already, you know, called Apple Care, and they did a lot of diagnostics. And then they said, well, just let us know what else. And, you know, try this, try that. And so I emailed him that, and he called me, and Cody called me from – he's up in Sacramento. He called me and said, send me pictures. So that's why there's pictures of this. And then he said, yeah, that's right. So let me call around and see if I can get a replacement stick of RAM for you. He called me back and said, none of the Apple stores anywhere in the country have anything. But here's what we want you to do. Put the stick back in, bring the whole thing to the Apple store, let them test it. If they agree there's something wrong with it, they will then give you the Mac back, take it back home, and in a month or two, when they get new RAM, you will we'll come back up and we'll install it for you at no charge. And I said, yeah, no. Thanks.
Too long.
I'm not going to make two or three trips up there, et cetera, et cetera, for the RAM. So I checked. Mac, say Otherworld Computing has it. Do you think, Renee, or anybody, it's the same? I mean, they say it's compatible.
It's compatible. I don't know if it's identical, but it's
compatible. I'm sure it's not identical.
maybe you just discovered another one of the supply constraints, Leo.
Yeah. Well, in fact, I then got a call from Austin, where they're making these things, and from a very nice lady, Christina, who said, "Well, we're calling all the people who have problems with their Mac Pro, see what's going on."
Right.
So I filled her in on this problem. She said, "Well, let me get back to you." So I haven't heard back from them. But meanwhile, for $74, I ordered another 4 gigabyte module. It should come today. Yeah, it's not this. They say it's, you know, it has all of the things that Apple does. You know, it's Apple specified thermal sensor, for instance. But I don't know. I mean, I don't know if it's the wrong thing.
I've used them for years. I've always been good.
Otherworld Computing is great, as far as I'm concerned.
I just show my age. Every time I see prices for RAM, I always think of the early days when I...
4 gigs, $75.
Cost as much as a car.
I was like, I remember I bought a 64, I think it was a 64 gig, or 64 meg for $900.
It's DDR3, it's ECC, although it's interesting. If the modules are bigger than, I think, 8 gigs, then it gets a different kind of ECC. Anyway, right. It's very complicated. So my first question was, and I think we already figured this out, it used to be you had to add RAM in pairs.
Yep. Yeah, you haven't had to do that for a while.
But yeah, you haven't had to do that for a while. I don't know. The Xeon is not a very modern chip. But so I wasn't
three
sure.
Anyway.
But it comes with three anyway. It comes with 12 gigs and an empty slot, right?
Yeah, but there is three-channel RAM, I think, on the new Mac Pros, like on all recent Halo machines. So I don't know how the twos match into the threes anymore.
Does it even matter?
Maybe you need six now because it's a multiple.
The only thing that we tend to be what we tend to be superstitious about is we tend to make sure that all the RAM is made by the same manufacturer.
Well, this won't be because
we'll see how that goes.
Yeah,
I don't really need proof.
It because for me, 12 gigs is plenty.
Right,
but for you, you said you want more memory to really do those benchmarks. You need more memory, so I'll give this to you after I get the new RAM in, and we'll see.
You just give the RAM to us, and we'll put it in.
It's not what Apple said is not unreasonable. But would have been. It would have been nice if they'd said, "Oh, good, we'll send you a new module. Send the old one back. It's clearly scuffed."
They've never done that.
They don't do that.
No, ever,
ever.
No, because it's then it's a warranty issue. They just asked a user to do something that typically they consider something they should do.
Although it is user upgradable part.
It is, but it's but they don't want to be accountable. They don't want to send you something new and then have you come back and say, "Oh, it didn't work." Because you know you get it.
For all they know, I scuffed it. For all they know, when we pulled it out, I stepped on it. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So they don't know what happened.
And Leo Laporte.
And you can clearly see me with my thumb on the gold contact. So obviously I ruined that RAM anyway.
There was no static wristband.
I was about to say, yep.
Apple busted. I'm busted.
I kind of miss the static wristbands.
But do you think that, I think that does mean that maybe that's one supply constraint. They don't have separate memory. They said it will be available roughly the same time the next shipment of Mac Pros is available.
Maybe that's the reason that they're waiting.
So maybe it is RAM.
They should just call. They should call Crucial. They should call
MacWorld, Mac Sales, Otherworld Computing.
Otherworld Computing, and just say, "Hey, we could use some RAM."
Then, of course, on Google Plus, everybody weighs in. I see no evidence that this is the cause of the issue. The protective covering looks fine. Okay, whatever.
Obvious Photoshop.
I have a degree in biology from Trevor.
I mean, whether the scuff did anything or not, it's clearly scuffed. That doesn't seem right.
Mm. Well, and what we know is that we took it out and everything worked fine. So it's not that we looked at it and said it was scuffed and decided it was broken. It was that all the tests were failing. Then we took that out, and then all the tests were working.
It doesn't look good.
No.
It should not be scuffed. You know, I would not trust it if it was scuffed. Yeah. It's better not to have a scuffed RAM.
Whether that's a problem or not, it's not right.
It ain't right.
And it did squish this trace. This trace is definitely squished. So
also, if you unpack it and it looks like it was licked at the factory,
yeah,
I would not sign for the package.
Somebody spit in my Mac Pro. Is this for Leo? Oh, that guy.
I couldn't resist. It's just such a sexy design.
Oh no! Stop it.
That's oh my God! There's a hippie chest hair inside the fan too.
All right, that's the update on the Mac Pro. It's working just fine now with 12 gigs, the way God intended it. And I'll put the other world in, but I don't even really need it. It's for your benefit, because
yep.
I don't. I mean, 12 gigs. I could be using a Chromebook for what I do with that thing.
Don't say that in public.
You know, just to honk off a lot of people, you should attach it to a VGA monitor. like an old one.
I got an old sun monitor around here somewhere.
Go to the recycling depot. But next time you just see that big pile of monitor, just grab one. Not even a ViewSonic.
And then Keith did all the updates in 2.
Packard Bell VGA screen.
Yeah. I really think that Apple's doing its best. I really do. And I'm not upset. I'm really not. And it works. It works fine. And it looks good with a VGA monitor. Actually, the Apple has no idea who I am through all of this. Cody says, you sound like you know what you're talking about. So I said, yeah, thank you. I don't. Keith does. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a break, come back. We'll talk about the iTunes Festival and Noling.
It's all about Noling.
It's all about the Noling. Didn't know this.
You didn't know that.
Is it named after Thomas Noel, the creator of Photoshop? It's another Noel. Our show today brought to you by something that is actually quite Noly. Squarespace. They're making the web beautiful one site at a time. Could be your site. Squarespace is the all-in-one platform. Hosting, software, beautiful templates, a logo creator tool, iOS apps, everything for one low price. And they are constantly improving the platform. Because they host the software and do the hosting, the improvements happen automatically. You don't have to do upgrade security fixes. Visit squarespace.com. Press the Get Started button. You can try it free for 2 weeks. No credit card needed or anything. Just pick from one of their beautiful 25 templates. You can use the logo creator tool to create your own logo. Squarespace, if you need help, it's easy to use. I don't think you'll need help, but if you want help, 24/7 live chat and email support right there from New York City. Plus, they've got a beautiful new customer help site with self-help articles, video workshops. They've really done a nice job of making it easy. But, you know, you don't have to be a coder to do this. I mean, you can. They have a developer platform that's even more incredible. But really, anybody can make a unique, beautiful site with Squarespace. All the sites, all the templates now have e-commerce, which is great for, they can accept donations. It's great for a nonprofit or a cash wedding registry or a school fund drive. It starts as low as $8 a month with the annual plan. That includes a free domain name. All the annual plans do. If you want commerce, yes, you can sell one product for $8, but up to 20 products for $16. And unlimited products, digital, physical, services for $24. And they include real-time carrier shipping, label printing via ShipStation, integrated accounting from Xero. It is amazing what you get for a very affordable price. And Squarespace sites never go down. Elegant, clean, beautiful. I want you to start your free 2-week trial right now. No credit card needed. Start building your website when you decide to sign up for Squarespace. All we ask is use our offer code MacBreak. By the way, we've simplified the offer code. It's just MacBreak. No number, no month, nothing. Just MacBreak. You'll get 10% off. Squarespace.com. The offer code is MacBreak. Please use it so they know that that's where you heard it. We thank them so much for their support. We're rooting for you. We're rooting for you, Squarespace. We love them. Noling. This is an article from the Australian newspaper, news.com.au, and a very interesting article that submits that perhaps the secret to Apple's retail success is Noling. The term was coined by a janitor, Andrew Cromelo, who worked in Frank Gehry's furniture fabrication shop. Gehry, one of the world's most famous architect in many ways, and certainly an innovator in his designs. You've seen beautiful, swoopy-doopy Gehry buildings all over.
Great furniture, evidently.
Mickey Mouse Symphony Orchestra Center in Los Angeles, whatever it's called, the Disney, is Gehry. So is Experience Music Project, I think. He was designing chairs. A lot of architects do this. Mies van der Rohe did it.
Yeah, they look very much Gaudi like his buildings.
Yeah. Swoopy-doopy? Ooh, beautiful. Yeah, they do. They look like his buildings. Anyway, he was designing chairs for a company called Knoll, a design firm known for its angular furniture. The janitor noted as he was tidying up, the Gehry's tools were all arranged at right angles on the surfaces. He's one of those guys.
I'm into right angles.
And he called the style of organization Knolling because they were designing chairs for Knoll. Kind of interesting. A contemporary artist, Tom Sachs, who also worked in Gehry's shop, made it into his personal mantra, always be knolling.
And knolling is half the battle.
Yeah.
Like trolling, but you're waiting for someone to say, is this all organized correctly? And the other guy goes, I don't know.
Here's the rules for always be knolling. This is from 10 Bullets, his 2009 studio manual. did you do a search for Noel?
This is the idea is that you take similar items and you put them next to each other.
Yeah, let me give you the rules.
Yeah,
the rules.
Go ahead.
Scan your environment for materials, tools, books, music, etc., which are not in use, and put them away. If you're not sure, leave it out. Group all like objects. Group all like objects, and then. Oh, Andy's laughing, and I'm laughing because I think our houses don't look like this.
This is where refugees from rolling and knolling internment camps come for peace and safety.
Like never be knolling is Andy's motto. And then finally, a line or
be
square.
Free.
Fly
table
free.
Tie and laptop I sent back 2 years ago. Work shoes that I got from my dad's garage when we closed up the house but haven't touched since.
Excuse me, when you see Campbell somebody who's doing this, you think they are mentally ill. You don't assume that they are.
I go through states of knolling. You know, which
yeah,
are
I
the,
try.
No, no, my house will be like a mess. But if I have enough conference calls, my house will become very clean. And as soon as it becomes clean, I start doing exactly what it says here. I didn't know that it was called
a line
something.
Or square. All objects to either the surface they rest on or the studio itself. So everything's at right angles. Mm-hmm. And apparently, Steve Jobs knew this. Or somebody did, because if you look at an Apple store, it's all knolled. It's perfect. No wires visible. Frankly, very few curves visible. It's all squared off, right angles.
See, I don't know. It's just that in high school, in the 80s, I worked in the computer department and the office equipment department at a big department store. And apparently we got memos about knolling as well. And we called it, get that crap off the shelves, make sure everything's lined up perfectly. That was like the last thing we had to do, like after we'd sent the customers home before we could go get our coats and go home, which was to make sure all the laptops were square, make sure that all the everything's been put back away. I'm not. I enjoy those knolling pictures because I just enjoy. There is something about my personality that says that I love seeing like 400 different types of phones in one gallery all lined up nicely. I'm not sure that if I would take all of the 400 phones in or in my hardware library and line them up that way, but it's nice.
So I
knolling is just self-soothing behavior for a certain type
it
of
is.
Personality.
It, that's right. Some people just
and
has
there's,
to be
there's
that
nothing
way.
Negative about it. It's just that sometimes you get a certain amount of pleasure of the meditative act, just like raking those parallel lines in a sand bed.
Yeah.
Saying, I'm going to take everything out of my pocket. I'm going to take all the cards out of my wallet. I'm going to line them up very nicely. I'm going to observe them as a collection of objects. I'm going to delete everything that looks superfluous, and then I'm going to put it right back.
I should give full credit to Emma Overton, who wrote the original article for the Australian site AskMen.com. Become a better man.
Men.
Become a better man by knolling. And then, I didn't know this, but apparently Conan O'Brien has a term for it. Stackenblocken.
It's a German game show channel. That's right, a German game show channel. And
it's very old.
This is weird. This is very strange. It says right now they're in the middle of a show called Stackenblocken, where contestants have to arrange items on a dresser at right angles. That passes for fun in Germany. Let's take a look.
It's a little Germanic.
3, 2, 1, los! Stackenblocken.
Oh, no! He's measuring it with a T-square. Oh, wow. Oh, my. You really must stock and block and correctly. It's a little OCD.
I don't think that's really a show.
Still not as bad as some of the Japanese game shows.
Now, would you, if you were really, really into this, would people just call you anal?
Yeah. It's OCD, yes. I think, really. Mm-hmm. But well, there is something to be said for...
If you're lining it up, it's knolling. If you then have to touch the tip of the screwdriver 9 times and then the tape measure 4 times, it's something that perhaps that you should seek a medical
solution for. That's OCD. But there is a lot to be said for having a tidy workspace where everything kind of is where it should be. And your mind then doesn't have to spend any energy on the workspace. It spends energy on the work.
Right.
But there are
right.
a lot of well-organized empty stores, too. I mean, it's not certainly not the secret to Apple's success.
I got to say, the people ruin it. It's stack and blocking when the store opens, but then I've never seen an Apple store that's not overflowing with round people.
All on Facebook.
Screwing it all up. So I think if really
like
Apple...
Like those children with their chubby, chubby cheeks.
Hate that.
They should be ascetic. They should be linear.
Yes.
In Syracuse, and it's necessary but not sufficient to Apple's success.
Yes. Did you all read the excerpt from the new book about Apple and Tim Cook in the Wall Street Journal? Should I summarize it a little bit? This is going to be a book. Let me see if I can get the name of it.
Revelation, Leo.
It actually explains quite a bit.
It was such a good piece. I actually pre-ordered the book.
Yeah, I can't wait to read it. Although some people think it's kind of a hit piece on Cook.
I'm not looking forward to the book. I'm going to read it, but I'm not looking forward to it.
Haunted Empire, it's called, Apple After Steve Jobs. It's written by former Wall Street Journal reporter Yukari Kane. And, you know, the hit on it, and I think this came from Jim Dalrymple, was that a lot of this is secondhand, right?
Yeah.
That she wasn't there, but of course not. That's how reporting is. Shortly after Tim Cook succeeds Steve Jobs as CEO of Apple, she says, he told a confidant, he got up every morning reminding himself, just do the right thing. Don't worry about what Steve would do. Right on. We've talked a little bit about that, mm-hmm. that can haunt you. It hurt Ford for a long time, for instance. This, you know, Henry Ford looking over your shoulder.
Cook's mentioned that several times.
Yeah. He apparently is also fairly demanding. We know him as the supply guy. But in meetings, apparently, he could be fairly demanding. Although I don't know a tech CEO when you finally hear of these stories of Bill Gates.
Well, they're not demanding. What is wrong with them? I mean,
that's their job.
There was that story years ago where they had a problem in China, and he turned at the guy and he goes, "Why are you still here?" I mean, that was still when he
right
was
right on.
Chief information.
And then the guy left the table, did not go home to pack, and went right to the airport, and then went to China. Yeah.
Right. One planner recalls Cook saying, "Your numbers make me want to jump out that window over there." But didn't Steve Jobs said, "You're ruining my company"?
Oh, he said a lot of things.
Jeff Bezos has said exactly that. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, this is what a good CEO maybe has to do.
But the impression that I get from I don't know as many people who've worked with Tim as I did. People who had worked with Steve Jobs. But the impression that I get from those conversations is that if Tim Cook says something like that, you know that it's a rational response to actual data.
Right.
And that if you present him with the exact same situation a week later, he will have the exact same type of response. And that what's the improvement that a lot of people are citing is that we feel as though that the CEO is on an more predictable and even keel.
Yeah. If it's related to something.
I mean, I don't think I would survive long with a boss that's quite that demanding, but it seems to be well within the bandwidth of when you have a job that reports directly to the CEO, well, damn it, you really do have to have the spreadsheet with the right numbers, and if there's any fudge in that number, you better make sure you get that out before you go into the conference room.
Yeah, I don't think that's
that's not irrational, right?
Yeah. Here's the paragraph I think that's – to me, was most interesting. Meetings with Cook could be terrifying, she writes. He exuded a zen-like calm and didn't waste words. Quote, talk about your numbers. Put your spreadsheet up, he'd say as he nursed a Mountain Dew. Some staffers wondered why he wasn't bouncing off the walls from the caffeine. But remember, Steve Jobs very famously said enough small talk. You know,
I think the story was, I guess someone, it was like a Monday, and someone came in. They're starting a meeting with Steve Jobs and they asked him how his weekend was. And I think that the quote was, he said, let's bring the intelligence of the conversation up, shall we?
Yeah.
Like,
enough,
you know, just
small
not
talk.
Yeah. And I will say that as
we got a job to do.
And Andy can probably attest to that, and Renee, you know, if you're at Apple at Apple meetings, they are notoriously short on small talk during. Like, you walk into a conference room and the only thing they're going to talk about is what you came to talk about. Now, if you go to lunch.
Right.
You can talk
that's
about anything
different.
You want, but literally in those rooms, the only thing I've
that's a
ever
good
heard
corporate
of,
culture.
It's
to
a,
me,
and it is across the board. Every Apple, place I've ever been, to have meetings for whatever reason. We used to do a lot of software development as a third-party developer. And we'd show them what we were working on. Just zero small talk.
I don't have too much of a problem with that. When Cook turned the spotlight on someone, she goes on to write, he hammered them with questions until he was satisfied. Why is that? What do you mean? I don't understand. Why are you not making it clear? He may not have said it like that. He might have said it nicely. I don't. Why is that? What do you mean? I don't understand.
And Bill Gates had a reputation for doing the same thing.
Jeff Bezos, the meetings at Amazon are silent for the first 15 minutes because if you're presenting in a meeting, you are allowed to write a six-page press release for what this feature will do. The press release is the press release that will go out to the public so that it's focused on how is this going to make the public's life better, right?
Right.
And you give it to all the executives in the room. They read it for 15 minutes, and then you begin. I think this is a very smart thing in a corporate culture to have a culture of we don't have time to waste.
Right.
Let's get to work.
Especially at that size. I mean, that's at a massive scale.
Yeah. Cook also knew the power of silence. He could do more with a pause than Jobs ever could do with an epithet. When someone was unable to answer a question, Cook would sit without a word while people stared at the table and shifted in their seats. The silence would be so intense and uncomfortable that everyone in the room wanted to back away. Unperturbed, Cook didn't move a finger as he focused his eyes on the squirming subject. Sometimes he'd take an energy bar from his pocket while he waited for an answer, and the hush would only be ruined by the crackling of the wrapper. That's
that only
spooky.
Happened once. That guy's in trouble.
That's Dr. No stuff.
That you imagine someone like leaving Apple, then 5 years later, every time like when their kids like opens up a wrapper or something, all of your stacks come in plastic baggies. Nothing that crinkles.
He gets up at 4:30 or 5 a.m., hits the gym, eats protein bars throughout the day, simple meals like chicken and rice for lunch. Inhuman stamina. He could fly to Asia, spend 3 days there, fly back, land at 7 a.m., be in the office by 8:30 interrogating somebody about the numbers. Relentlessly frugal. For many years, Tim Cook lived in a rental unit in a dingy ranch-style building with no air conditioning. He said it reminded him of his humble roots. When he finally purchased a house, it was a modest 2,400-square-foot home built on a half lot with a single parking spot. This is a good measure. In Silicon Valley. His first sports car was a used Porsche Boxster. Ooh.
Who would buy a used?
Probably wasn't even allowed in the Apple parking lot.
The poor man's Porsche. Even his hobbies were hardcore, cycling and rock climbing. I don't know. This sounds like a good guy, actually.
The kind of guy who gets to be CEO of Apple.
Yeah. He gave away the frequent flyer miles he racked up as Christmas gifts. He volunteered at his soup kitchen during Thanksgiving. He raised money for multiple sclerosis with a 2-day cycling event across Georgia. I mean, I have to respect him. We all heard the story of the shareholder meeting, right, last week.
I love that story. I don't think we talked.
No, it happened after the show. So there was a conservative group in there, a conservative think tank in the shareholders meeting, and they raised the question with Tim Cook, you know, all of this environmental stuff you do hits the bottom line, hits your return on investment. You really ought to be paying attention to this, you know, the cost of this. They were pushing a shareholder proposal that would have required Apple to disclose the costs of its sustainability programs and to be more transparent about its participation in trade associations and business organizations promoting environmental sustainability. Shareholders rejected the proposal, just less than 3% of the vote. But during the Q&A session, the representative of the NCPPR asked Mr. Cook two questions. First, he challenged an assertion from Mr. Cook that Apple's sustainability programs and goals, for instance, 100% of its power coming from green sources, are good for the bottom line. He said, isn't that just because government subsidies on green energy? And then he said he asked him to commit then and there to only doing things that were profitable. And this is Brian Chaffin writing in the Mac Observer. What ensued was the only time I can recall seeing Tim Cook angry. And he categorically rejected the worldview behind the NCPPR question. He said, there are many things Apple does because they are right and just. A return on investment is not the primary consideration on such issues. He says, I don't consider the bloody ROI when we work on making devices accessible by the blind.
What I love is the next one where he says, if you
want me to stop doing things if you want me to do things only for ROI reasons, you should get out of this stock.
Yeah.
And he's not saying that he never pays attention to ROI, but he's definitely not saying that he's only going to pay attention to ROI.
Get out of my stock.
Also, it was a really impudent question. It's okay if it were a legitimate shareholder raising a question saying, hey, you know, I don't particularly care about your corporate imperatives. I invest in your company because I think that it'll yield better returns for my clients' and retirement portfolios. That's kind of okay, and maybe they would have phrased it differently. But this was a guy who, from a think tank group, who just wanted to get a soundbite they could put on a postcard or a newsletter.
He got the soundbite. So Yukari Kane's book about Tim Cook is coming out just a few days from now, March 18th. Haunted Empire, Apple after Steve Jobs.
That has to be one of the many downsides of being CEO of Apple, where almost every other executive at every other company is allowed to simply head up a company with lots of responsibilities, lots of opportunities, and lots of challenges. Tim Cook now has to be a celebrity, where people have to start hammering at his personal life. And the fact that he doesn't wear his personal life in the form of a press release means that it's a mysterious thing that people now have to investigate. And I imagine that that's just a weekly bummer for him to have to deal with that kind of stuff.
Gil Emilio said that when he was briefly and notoriously Apple CEO. He said, I thought I was here to run a company. That's right, like running a religion. Yeah. You know, it's a very different job. Anyway, I think on balance, Tim Cook comes out pretty good. There's still the question, as there always will be, about Tim Cook. He's clearly not Steve Jobs. Does somebody in Apple have the vision that Steve Jobs did?
And I don't think we're going to know for 3 to 5 years.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's for it to understand how culturally, you know, what it's done.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which is why a Haunted Empire book is probably premature. But again, I'll wait till I read it.
Yeah, it's a title that is meant to get headlines and to sell books.
Yeah,
but it's interesting. It's just like when Leander wrote the first really good book. Excuse me, the first real book on Johnny Ive. The fact that this is a new book that it covers a subject that hasn't really been covered in such depth, we'll have to get our hands on it and see if that jibes with reality. But the fact that this book is out makes it an interesting book for anybody.
I look forward to it, but I my hopes were dashed a lot when I read the New Yorker articles. I thought that article was
articles. What were the New Yorker articles also?
There was an article she wrote in the New Yorker that was not put in the magazine, but was put online, and it read like one of those analysts who spent years covering Apple but never understood them. It was a typical, you know, Apple hasn't put out any new great products. Apple's doomed without Steve Jobs. And it really, if I hadn't seen her name on it, I would have thought it was just another one of those, you know, wacky analysts and not thought about it for 2 seconds. So I hope the book is a lot deeper than that article was.
We're going to take a break. Come back. We'll talk about Snow Leopard, end of the line for this 4-year-old operating system. The Apple TV rumors. True? Nope. And a lot more.
Should you have like a clip-on beard standing by so that it's just
I can't even imagine without, him saying
without
it.
The
He's
bottle
so
of Heineken
brilliant.
Without the clip-on beard.
Well, I got to get Jim on the show at some point. We'll talk about that all in just a second. Our show today brought to you by FreshBooks. The simple online accounting solution built for small business owners like me, like you. It's tax time. Ugh. Don't we dread April 15th? It's just a nightmare because now you're in that, probably very likely in that position where you got all the, you know, the 1099s and now you're looking through receipts and digging through invoices, going through the records. If you had only been using FreshBooks this year, the simple cloud accounting solution that makes tax time a breeze with FreshBooks. Well, it starts with invoices. You create beautiful, professional-looking invoices. That's really what I use them for. And I started using FreshBooks 10 years ago. I just was a lifesaver for me. But you can also capture and track expenses now. You can get real-time business reports with just a couple of clicks. They've got mobile apps which make it easy to use FreshBooks on your phone or your tablet to keep track of time and hours and expenses. Just the fact that made it easier for my clients to pay was such a relief. I actually got paid faster because I started using FreshBooks. Used them for years until I, you know, finally had. It took 4 or 5 people to replace FreshBooks in an accounting department. The sooner you start using FreshBooks, the sooner you can start focusing on doing what you love. Focus on the work, not the paperwork. They've got a great deal right now. GetFreshBooks.com. They've extended the free offer to 2 months, 60 days. So visit GetFreshBooks.com, sign up. You'll be joining the 5 million users who really believe that and know that FreshBooks is changing their life. I don't think that's overstating it. It certainly did mine. Make sure you put Mac Break Weekly, if you do get FreshBooks, in the How You Heard About Us section. 60-day free trial. Tax time will be a breeze. GetFreshBooks.com. We thank them so much for their support of Mac Break Weekly. Make sure you tell them that's where you heard it. Have we knolled our desks here? Wait a minute. I'm sorry.
It's hard because it's round.
Damn,
the desk
round
is round.
Desk. There, the handle's got to be right. We mentioned last week the iTunes Festival at South By. That's exciting.
It's going to be big.
Yeah.
They added more people since the last time we talked about it. They got Soundgarden playing.
Well, and Gruber thinks that this is going to be the release of 7.1, too.
Which would be interesting because it would be the first time they released an OS without, or an X.1 without a Gold Master seed.
They haven't done the Gold Master yet.
Nope.
They've done how many? 8 betas?
Seven, I think.
So, according to Gruber, Apple's going to stream the performances at South By. They've always done it on iTunes. You watch live, it's fun, but they're also going to do it on iOS. He says, I've heard from a little birdie, the app requires iOS 7.1. So,
well, they're going to have to hurry up. That's all I got to say. It's coming up.
It's next week. Well, when's music? What is it? It's soon, right?
I think it's next
Coldplay, week. Keith Urban. He's so great on American Idol. No, I'm just kidding. Kendrick Lamar, Pitbull, Soundgarden, Imagine Dragons, Five Nights. It starts March 11th.
Soon.
That's
next
Coldplay.
Week.
9 days.
So do you think? Is that credible? I mean, John's pretty connected.
Got good sources.
That'd be a good way to get a lot of people upgrading.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what? That's good timing, right? You can't run that. You can't use the app unless you run 7.1, and you have one day to install it.
Yeah, exactly.
Their adoption rates are so high anyway.
Anyway, they don't need to do anything.
And also, we forget that the iPhone is such a mainstream device that what percentage of the people worldwide who have iPhones or even care about South by Southwest right. music?
I great care. Great Saturday, March 15th, Keith Urban, Willie Nelson, and Mickey Guyton. I want that show.
On your iPhone.
On my iPhone or iPad. All right, well, from John's lips to Tim's ears. Ooh, that sounds a little dirty.
You've been reading my fanfic.
There's a lot of necessary updates in that, and the sooner it comes out, the better.
Yeah. Will people be a little reluctant, though, to jump to 7.1 after the hazards of 7.0?
If they get a respring a day, probably not.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is an eagerly awaited update for a lot of people. This is not incidental.
Still, your advice would be to wait, right?
I usually upgrade some of my devices and then leave other ones
behind. Only 5 betas, the chat room reminds us. Thanks, Dark Macintosh.
You know, it's weird. Has everybody updated all of their 4 real day-to-day use devices to
7.06? Better do that. And 10.9.2.
I mean from iOS 6 to iOS 7.
Oh
yeah, yeah.
I still have one holdout.
I think I went a week with 7 and then just upgraded everything. I was just like, okay, this is much better.
I have an iPod Touch still on 6 for testing, but my Mac Pro just went to Mavericks yesterday.
I admit, after getting used to 7, I kept on looking back at 6 and it felt so ancient that I was like, oh, I can't.
You waited to go to Mavericks till yesterday, Renee Ritchie?
I still haven't gone to Mavericks.
I mean, I usually wait 6 months to a year on whatever machine I use for podcasting just in case, because sometimes it's weird software that, what's it called? Caster app.
Yeah. We are so different because I actually install the new version of the operating system during the podcast.
During the show. Right.
Almost always during the – it's a long-standing tradition on Twitch.
I think the only Mavericks we have are the computers that we bought since it was released or, you know, come with Mavericks. And so we've got like 3 or 4 machines that have Mavericks on them. But outside of that, we're all still 10.86.
I don't have a machine.
This is not a specific vote against Mavericks or iOS 7, but my day-to-day use iPad is still running iOS 6. Only because I haven't, every time I think I'm going to get around to it, I don't get around to it. And I've asked myself, well, why do I have to get it done right now and put things off? It's like, okay, iOS 7, there's a lot of things I like about it, but nothing that I have to do. On my 15-inch MacBook Pro, I still have it on the previous edition. Again, because I I have Mavericks running on two different new machines that I've bought since it came out. And I like it. It's just that I don't miss anything when I switch back to this other computer that still has the older operating system on it. That's unprecedented in my history. I feel as though I really should. Like I said, it's not a vote against iOS 7. It's not a vote against Mavericks. It's just that there hasn't been that moment that said, "Ooh, here's an app I really want to use that requires this. I better download and update this right now."
Well, you better update it if you're on Snow Leopard. Snow Leopard, what, 4.5 years old?
It's frozen.
That article's not right. That article's horrible.
It seems older than that. Are you talking about Greg Kaiser's article in Computer
World?
Yeah,
it's horrible.
Okay, let's take it out of the equation.
Peter Cohen got so angry he wrote an instant rebuttal.
Did he?
Yeah. Because it's still available for sale on Apple.com. It's still being upgraded as recently as September, I think. It was not susceptible to this SSL hack, therefore it did not need to be patched.
It didn't have the go-to-fail problem.
Yes, correct.
So Apple hasn't retired it from support.
No, not yet.
Just didn't need to update it for that.
Well, Greg Kaiser, what the hell? I mean, I trust Computer World, so I went with it. So, yes, I did notice you could still buy Snow Leopard. So Apple's made no announcement, we're not going to support Snow Leopard.
So really the take on this is if you want to stay secure, just keep on using Snow Leopard.
Well, use something that doesn't have this bug. So you could, one of the reasons I finally updated was I had to do the SSL bug fix anyway, and I figured out I might as well just put Mavericks on.
The SSL bug is a Mavericks issue. It's not Snow Leopard, Lion, or Mountain Lion, according to Peter.
I don't remember if it hit Mountain Lion or not, but it's been about a year.
Peter says neither Lion nor Mountain Lion. Snow Leopard, I'm really actually relieved because there are Macs as little as 5 years old that can't go beyond Snow Leopard.
Right. People still use it for the Rosetta. Is it Rosetta?
It's the last Rosetta, yeah.
Yeah.
So if you have
you want to run Photoshop 5.
Right. If you have apps that were on PowerPC, you can't go past Snow Leopard. Yeah.
But as we always say, it will continue to run all the software that it ran at the time when you decided to pass on the upgrade. Right. You can't complain that every piece of software and every operating system every piece of software ever written will always work with the machine that I had when I was in middle school.
Well, I apologize. I mean, I should thank you, Peter Cohen, for setting the record straight. I used to think I used to think of Computer World as a reliable source. Right. I apologize.
That one author has not got a good track record when it comes to Apple. I mean, there's a lot of really good writers there, but that one author doesn't. He likes to stick it to Apple, it seems.
Peter says Greg Kaiser has a very long history of twisting whatever he can find with an anti-Apple slant. He's an Apple troll. So Computer World, maybe you want to think about.
Let him cover something else.
Moving him over to the Microsoft side. Wow, that's... I apologize, folks, for repeating that story. I think I talked about it on a Twit on Sunday. We'll have to fix that next week.
Well, I mean, the truth will be when there is an issue that affects Snow Leopard, whether Apple updates it and does so in a timely fashion. I just think you can't tell that based on them not having to update something.
It didn't have a problem, so we didn't fix it. That seems reasonable.
Is that okay with you, Mr. Kaiser?
Jeez.
But it did lead to a good conversation about who upgrades when.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. The security, and you know that well from Security Now, Leo, is that people report security issues without giving them any context. And it happens so often, it ends up just scaring people, which is...
Yeah, and it's hard work. I'm glad we have Steve Gibson who kind of vets this stuff. And then I try to always think, with the grain of salt in this thing. This one, I trusted Computer World. That's terrible. Now I'm nervous about all these other stories. Apple details Touch ID... and the A7 Secure Enclave and updated iOS security document.
Which is actually terrific. That whole document is fantastic.
Secure Enclave is, it sounds like a place where data is stored securely. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's that custom A7 chip. They have a secure enclave on that chip, and the Touch ID sensor is actually individually paired
with
every A7 chip. So if you swap out the sensor, if you get your hands on the phone and think you could just swap out the sensor, it won't work. You literally have to have those two components together, and it goes through a hardware channel. It never goes up into the higher functions of the phone, into RAM or anything else. They put a lot of effort into making that incredibly secure.
Well, enclave is provisioned during fabrication of the chip with a unique ID. So each chip has a built-in unique ID Other parts of the system can't get it. It is not known to Apple, according to this document. When the device starts up, an ephemeral key is created, is mashed up with the UID, probably in a hash function, and that's what's used to encrypt the secure enclave's portion of the device's memory space. So that's secure. Even Apple can't get into that.
Well, I think that also points to that Apple's not going to make this just a convenience item. I think that there's I think you go through that kind of trouble to use it for a lot of things.
I have to ask Steve about this because they're not using hash. They're using a term I have not heard before, tangled. I don't know if this must be, Steve will know if this is a standard security term. Data that is saved to the file system by the secure enclave is encrypted with a key tangled with the UID and an anti-replay counter. Sounds good to me. I'll take two.
There were a lot of people at Apple worked really hard to make that. I mean, some people thought it would come out last year, but they really took their time and did a lot of smart stuff with it.
Note, by the way, that despite all the flames that Apple took for its fingerprint reader, nobody said anything about the Samsung S5 fingerprint reader.
I saw that a lot. Some people, but to be fair, Apple didn't get any heat until they actually shipped it. Al Franken didn't write his letter until the 20th, which was 10 days, and when it hit stores, and no security people could get their hands on it to test it until after it shipped. So hopefully, I don't think it's a fairness issue. As someone who's got friends who are going to buy Galaxy S5s, I just want to know that they are safe and secure and sort of how Samsung is implementing it.
Well, this is I tell you, Samsung has a template because this document is really great. They need to release something like this.
And my understanding is that Apple hasn't given it to third parties yet because it uses a yes-no token. That's what keeps it secure when it releases the information about the fingerprint. And securing that when it goes to third-party hands is probably trickier. And I'd be interested to see how Samsung is doing that because they did announce an SDK.
Apple says the A7 processor gathers the fingerprint data but can't actually read it. The exchange takes place between the A7 and the secure enclave, fully encrypted. It's over a serial peripheral interface bus that is encrypted and authenticated with a session key that is negotiated using the device shared key that is built into the Touch ID sensor in the secure enclave using AES key wrapping. This is serious stuff.
Yeah.
No third parties are allowed. There's no API, as you said. Touch ID authentication and the data associated with the enrolled fingerprints are not available to other apps or third parties. That does hobble what it can do. I mean, only Apple can use it.
For now. I mean, I think it's just a question of time.
Yeah. Well, because this kind of security has to be embedded inside hardware. And if you screw it up, you can't just do a software patch to fix it. It means you have to recall phones or at least decide that an entire generation of hardware is a complete write-off. So that's not surprising.
This also has information about how stuff is encrypted in iMessage. Well,
a big open question.
Yeah. Steve Gibson has held that the what Apple can do with iMessage, for instance, taking your message when you start up a new device, the iMessages then appear on that device, is a definite indication that Apple does have access to that data unencrypted.
The interesting thing is it looks like there's two systems there because they say that Apple makes a unique key for every device. So it'll try for a couple of days to deliver a message to a device, and using a unique key for that device, and if it can't, that message doesn't get there. But you can also backup iMessage to iCloud. So if you restore a device, it restores all the messages that device has received. And that's part of your normal iCloud backup. So it looks like there's two distinct sorts of ways that in which Apple is handling iMessage.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not enough of a security expert to vet this document, but kudos to Apple for publishing it. iOS security was published on Valentine's Day.
Love letter to security nerds.
Yeah. It does sound like it's using strong encryption. Each key pair, the private keys are saved in the device's keychain. The public keys are sent to Apple's directory service, as that all sounds reasonable.
Anybody wonder why they didn't release this last year?
Might have taken them this long to write it. It's a long
Touch
document.
ID stuff is new. The iMessage stuff probably isn't, but Touch ID stuff is new.
Yeah. I mean that when they first released the iPhone 5S, I'm wondering how long the vetting process took, and how many sign offs they had to get on the stock before they made it public.
All of them.
Yeah.
Wow. It's probably like a chocolate from an energy bar on the corners of every page of that.
They also cover Siri. They cover FaceTime. This really is a full document on how iOS keeps your stuff safe and private. I am sure that they released this now because of all the concern, thanks to the NSA and so forth, and they wanted to get it right. I think it probably took this long. You know, the NSA revelations were in June. The iPhone 5S came out in fall. I bet you they didn't have this document. It just took them a few months to write it or to put it all together and to vet it. And
it may represent things that have been added since.
Yeah, this is since NSA. Boy, I wish other companies would do this. Conclusion, a commitment to security. From hardware to encryption to device access, each component of the iOS security platform provides organizations with the resources they need to build enterprise-grade security solutions. That's an important phrase. They really want business to trust this as well as individuals.
The starting phrase is great, too. It says that iOS was built with security in mind first.
Yep.
That was a priority.
Yeah. iOS apps designed by Apple are built with enhanced security in mind. Safari offers safe browsing, EV certificates.
Yeah. It really does make you think that here in 2014, the features that people are most interested in a phone are the screen, the camera, the app library, and now the security too.
Yeah.
And now any company, even if they haven't been really paying attention to that so far, they now have to make sure that's part of the marketing as well. If it's on page 3, page 4, or page 8, it has to be there. Here is how we are securing your phone to make sure that it can't be it can't be compromised by either commerce-minded or government security-minded individuals.
They define tangling down here as this is actually a well-known I've never heard the term tangling, but they're using PBKDF2 and Steve's talked about PBKDF2.
And you have to think, if you have an antenna gate, people are frustrated, but if you start tying transactions and something goes wrong, people feel like you've got a hand in their wallet. So you want to make sure that you preemptively, especially if another manufacturer, whether it's Samsung or someone else, has a fingerprint sensor and it's not great and there's a lot of publicity around it and people start lumping Apple into it, they probably want to have a really good foundation for how their technology works out there ahead of time.
We'll get Steve to, if he's not, Security Now's coming up, if he hasn't already, we will get him to vet this document and translate it into English.
You know, there's also a precept in crypto that says that you make if you want to digitally secure something, you make it more secure by making your methods public, because that way the entire community can hammer on it and tell you where find the faults in it before you make a commit. Maybe this document is also part of that as well. That if there is something that is going to cause a lot of people to either correctly or because they don't know what they're doing, complain that, it doesn't have this, or that doesn't conform to this standard, or there's a weakness that was published 3 years ago in this paper right here, it gives Apple an opportunity to head that off and say, well, no, actually, we're going to add a section here that explains that that's not the case, or quietly say, yeah, guys, let's fix that before we actually put that under product, okay?
Also from Apple Insider, Daniel Aaron Dilger writing that Apple is preparing a software update, unclear if it'll come out with 7.1, that will fix some of the problems people have had and enhance functionality in the Touch ID, the fingerprint fade particularly. Authentec, which is the fingerprint recognition company that Apple bought the team is still there and they are working to improve the recognition software and will release an update relatively soon. Including a solution or an address, he believes, addressing that issue of fade, which is that after a while it stops recognizing your fingerprint. Has anybody tried, because I have a 5S, my daughter has it now, unfortunately, but has anybody tried Steve Gibson's technique of adding points? Does it seem to help?
I'm on 7.1, which has been rock solid for me, so I don't know if it's the 7.1, but I think in general it's working really well on whatever latest version they're doing.
Well, I'm sure we'll understand better when 7.1 comes out. Apple stores are discounting Apple TVs, adding a $25 iTunes card. That's led some to think, to predict a new Apple TV coming out this spring. Jim Dalrymple of The Loop says, nope. That's all he says, though. Nope. That's all he ever says. Yep. Nope. So,
a few words.
He's a reliable source, yes?
Yep.
That means not necessarily that there isn't a new Apple TV, but just that there won't be this one this spring.
There's new software almost definitely, but I guess the hardware is dependent on what Apple wants to do. If I don't think they're anywhere near going 4K yet. If they want to do an SDK that requires a lot more storage or memory or something better than half of an A5 chipset, they'll need new hardware. But if that stuff is not in their immediate pipeline, then the software update cannot come soon enough, and then they can release the hardware when they are closer to the other stuff.
Yep. Nope.
I think everybody's right. It's just a question of time scale.
So he highlights the could signal a new Apple TV on its way and then says nope. That implies never.
Well, no, I mean...
not Jim on its way.
They're prototype 2, 3, 4 years out. There's always something.
There will be a new Apple TV someday.
I mean, I think that the most likely would be to add more features to Apple TV. And if you're going to do that, then you talk about a WWDC. You know, you give people time to develop.
June. It's June. Yeah.
The evolution of the Apple TV has always been about the same very, very boring featureless rounded corner box and always about just simply adding more software and adding more services to it.
By the way, Apple TV is more than a hobby, at least if the B word determines that. It's a billion-dollar business, baby, Tim Cook said at the shareholders meeting. A little more difficult to call it a hobby these days. 10 million units, if you do the math.
Well, that was the billion counted content sales.
Ah, so it doesn't mean 10 million units.
No.
Okay.
But it's still, I mean, $1 billion is something a lot of companies would just love to have.
$1 billion in one fiscal year. Yeah.
Yeah.
For a hobby. Not a bad hobby.
It's an Apple scale hobby.
When do we think the next software update is? Soon?
I mean, I had to. If there is any SDK stuff involved, I think Alex is right, and we'll see it at WWDC. Yeah. But if it's strictly an interface improvement, then I think it could be earlier.
They need to improve the interface.
Yeah, I mean, I still can't search across content if I just want to find a movie and don't care if it's on iTunes.
That's
or Crunchyroll
what we need.
Or Netflix. Yeah, absolutely. Spotlight for Apple TV. Yeah.
I'm really looking forward to the next update too, because damn it, if I frozen again.
But you've frozen in such a handsome way.
at least I was smiling when it happened. Okay, it's just that usually when we see a Apple product be this static for this long without being short ordered, very few changes, but you're still widely available. That usually means they have something really, really, really momentous in terms of the next update coming. And that's what I'm looking forward to for the Apple TV. At this point, they've fallen way behind the Roku. And I don't think that it's because Apple has forgotten about it or doesn't care about it. It's because they're not making it incremental. The next change is not going to be incremental. It's going to be massive.
His lips never moved in that entire speech. It's amazing.
Never had a lesson.
He is. I think you ought to take up ventriloquism.
Ventriloquism.
Lipped up.
You see John Travolta?
Oh. That was painful. It's called too many martinis before the show.
I don't even know whose name he was trying to say.
Idina Menzel.
He didn't say Idina Menzel, did he?
One of my favorite bloggers said, you know, John Travolta's job on stage he only had to do two things: dye his hair a natural color and say Idina Menzel. He failed to do either of those things.
let me play the clip of I think he's on. This is on here. This is Oscar moments.
Please welcome the wickedly talented one and only Adele Dazzy.
What did he say? We got to play that again.
I don't think even he knows.
Listen.
Please welcome the wickedly talented one and only Adele Dazzy.
We're back.
Adele Dazzy. That doesn't sound right.
It's like someone on American Idol and I can't remember the words.
Well, I mean, so the funny thing about that, so, you know, we work on a lot of live shows with celebrities, and what you end up with, and you saw this with Harrison Ford as well, you can sell, like, if you work on enough of these shows, you can sell who was worried about their presentation and who didn't care. So, like, Harrison Ford obviously did not, I don't know, he's probably not on there. It's not like he made a mistake, but he obviously, the first time he saw whatever he was saying was on the air.
It's called cold reading versus...
Right, but you can tell there's some people who thought about it, they worked on it, you can tell they probably practiced it over and over and over again, and then there are some people who decided that they were just going to, you know, this is something they have to do, and so they got up and did it because they want the, you know...
So he was supposed to say... What was the name he was supposed to say again?
Idina Menzel.
And he said instead, So now there's a, if you go to Slate, there's a little calculator, the Adele Zazim name generator. You could Travoltify your name.
Oh, my gosh.
Let's see. Leo Laporte.
I swear you're going to crack up.
Luke Lopez.
Wait, I want to see Alex Lindsay. Hold on.
You can only do it once. They force you to reload so that they get all the pages. Yes. Alex Lindsay. And now the wonderfully talented, let's welcome to the stage the wonderfully talented Argyle Lewis.
Just call me Argyle Leswiz.
and that's the day that he finally believed his wife that, yeah, maybe I should get my contact lens prescription updated.
And then I actually very sympathetic, because once you've done that, you can't like say, well, let me fix it. No, they've moved on.
Yeah.
And you're, that's
you
it.
You live in infamy forever.
Forever in infamy. And then I want a video of Tim Cook just looking at him with a power bar.
Reddit, make it happen.
Yeah, Reddit will. Reddit will do it. Are you worried? Android is 62% of the tablet market. No, another bad stat.
No, it's not a bad stat, but it just shows how badly we do at reporting mobile devices. In the car industry, you know, stats like this wouldn't even be considered because it's mature enough to be segmented.
Right.
My understanding is a large number of those devices are just video players in Asia that just happen to run Android as a means to playing video.
Well, that's the first question you should always ask when you hear these things is worldwide or U.S.? This is worldwide.
Yeah, worldwide and U.S. and above, you know, $200, below $200.
Right, right. So worldwide, at all price points, Android tablets were 62% of sales in 2013, according to the Gartner Group. This is the first year that that's happened. Apple did sell, we should point out, 70 million iPads in that period.
The thing that's funny is when the iPad was hugely successful, Apple got lumped into media tablets or some other category that would ostracize them. And now the tablets are mainstream. Everything is lumped together in another way that makes the iPad look funny.
And if you look by vendor, Apple still is completely dominant. Apple is the on this pie chart. I love pie charts. Apple is blue. Others is black. And
others is those video players.
That's those little $200 or less video players. Samsung is light blue. So,
I still think when you look at Amazon and Samsung and possibly even Nokia/Microsoft, I think you really want to know who is selling those, because I think those are destined to fork. You know, I think those ones, I mean, Amazon's already basically forked it.
I think the Chinese ones aren't even running. They're running Android open source projects.
Yeah, it's AOSP. It's not Google services. Yeah, absolutely. So Google gets no benefit from that. It's
no,
just an open...
They get more benefit from iPad than they do from most of the
Android that's stuff. Right. That's probably true. 0.15% of mobile gamers account for 50% of all in-game revenue. You know who you are, by the way.
Oh, that would be me.
You're a whale.
We're the whales. Swerve announced the results of its first ever. It's some sort of marketing app for mobile. Mobile games monetization report. The vast majority of players never make any purchases. Only 1.5% of players active in a month, and this is based on a survey, 1.5% actually made an in-app purchase that month. 50% of the revenue is from the top 10 players who do make purchases. That means it's 0.15% of all players. 49% of all players make one purchase per calendar month. 13% make five or more. There's me and Alex. Most of the spend activity, a significant amount within the first 24 hours.
Right, because you're excited, you're trying to win.
Yeah.
And at some point you realize, I shouldn't be buying all
this. The average time to first purchase, just under 24 hours. And if you make a second purchase, and again, that's a small number, the average time lapse between first and second purchase, an hour and 40 minutes. So just some people have no self-control, basically.
And I didn't want to admit that.
Kevin Michaluk spent like $300 the first night on Candy Crush. It's just that's how they make it. God.
53% of players who made a purchase go on to make a repeat purchase within 14 days. 47% do not. 13.7% of new players accrue more than four purchases in the first 14 days. In other words, yeah, there's really a big divide between people who spend and people who don't. And if you spend, your chances are you're going to spend again and again and again.
And as a developer, I think it's important to look at the last story that we just talked about of the percentages of other devices and everything else when you're starting to think about that. I think that
the and I think that more the Google services Android, I think, is a much more important number, because I think the Google services Androids and the iOS are the two places that people are spending money. I think all the most of the other ones are
right. This is probably the most important. The average value of an in-app purchase is $5.94. The majority are between $1 and $5, but they don't contribute a huge percentage of the revenue. Purchases of over $50, who would spend that? Oh, never
mind. There are some people, they'll tell you, who spend $1,000 a weekend on those games.
But I'll I know that I've with Field Runners, I've like bought like, I don't know, thousands of points for like 10 or 20 bucks, and I use them for the next 6 months.
Right.
I absolutely don't understand, Renee, though. I'm sorry, go ahead.
You don't understand why you buy, you do in-app purchases?
No, I'm saying that I understand in-app purchases. I wish that someday I'm making so much money that I can blow $1,000 on a weekend of in-app purchases on a game and not even notice it.
It's a casino. You don't have to be making a lot of money. You look at the people who go into casinos and drop $1,000 in a weekend, and they aren't necessarily. They're betting the rent money.
But it's I don't know. It's
you know, the fun thing to do when you're leaving Las Vegas is to look for the people. The taxi cab driver told me this, who are walking to the airport with their roller bag behind them. He says, "See those guys? They
used it all.
They used their cab fare. Yeah. They got all they have left is a plane ticket out."
Makes you sad to be human.
Which is funny because I go to Vegas. We have to work there a lot, and I don't have any.
I never gamble.
Temptation. I guess I don't have the gene.
On the other hand, I spent $300 on Simpsons Tapped Out. I'm an idiot.
That's the, you know.
You know, when I was in Vegas, the thing that got me most upset on the casino floor was I already don't have a whole lot of affection for Judge Judy, because she's in my mind, she's someone who makes $40 million a year shrieking at people who are lower income and telling them that I don't have to listen to your explanation of anything because I'm smarter than you are. And so every time I leave my bank of elevators to go outside to get a cab or whatever, what did I pass by? A big bank of Judge Judy slot machines.
Yeah, isn't that funny?
So it's like, so I guess you don't really mind so long as it's a revenue positive thing for you. You not really don't care about responsible behavior.
I'd like to have been in that meeting. Judy, yeah. We got a great idea.
How much are they going to give me?
She takes out an energy bar and stares at you.
How much? Judge Judy slot machines. And they're, I saw them, too. They're at the Mandalay Bay. And I don't understand it.
I haven't seen any Judge
Judy. Why would you want to play a Judge Judy slot machine? What's the point of
that?
It's
more legit. There's a judge there. There's a judge there. They can't be cheating you.
Because you're stupid.
They got Vinnie Barbarino slot machines. I can't believe they haven't come to me and asked me. Would you like to be a slot machine?
Give you little tech tips every time you pull it down. But then they can have little things. They can have Andy and Renee and, you know, like get three Andys. And
no, so if I had a slot machine and you put money in the slot, I would just like the money would return back to you as saying, actually, have you gone to In-N-Out Burger? Because they're only here on the West Coast. You can get a double-double. Here, just don't give, you know, get something.
If you get three Andys, it just gives you all the money you've spent up to that point back. And then it tells you should leave.
By the way, this
no, it's like a penny bet will be Andy mode. There's the Renee mode, and then there's the Alex mode where you get cocktail service.
You bet Alex's. Hey. Yeah, they exactly. Like bet Alex's.
Exactly. It only takes 700 core things, but you get a lot of free drinks.
And in Alex mode, suddenly the resolution of the screen goes up like 1,000%.
Because they do have buttons on these slots. You know how much you want to spend, and it should be like an Andy, a Renee, and an Alex.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Giant Alex button.
Giant Alex. Boom. That's it. You got no more. This, by the way, was based on Freemium Games Examines Revenue in January 2014. And the data comes from, Swerve says, tens of millions of people. So fairly accurate. The CEO of Swerve said, what's interesting is while many consider the freemium model to be successful, there is still surprisingly little data relating exactly how consumers react or interact with freemium games. So now we know a little bit more. And I think if you're developing a freemium game, there's probably a lot of juice in there for you, something you should consider. You've got to get them early.
I hope this means there's some light at the end of the tunnel for some developer to say, well, maybe we don't have to release this as freemium. Maybe we can actually sell this as a $2.99 and you're out game.
No, I've already started seeing that. And I think it's very encouraging. We talk about that on iPad Today once in a while.
Threes
is a good example. It's $3? And there's no in-app purchases at all. And it's good game. I think there's going to be more of that stuff. Because I think people are reacting badly to this freemium thing.
Your lips to Tim Cook's ear.
you wonder if they... Actually,
you smell like Power Bar.
And Mountain Dew. You think, though, if any company would ever do something like that, it's, I say this in all sincerity, it would be Apple. If ever they looked at the numbers and said, this is crazy stupid, that here's a game being marketed as at kids, at, and we know for a fact that this is generating at least $280 per user per week. It's not coming from kids who have 8-year-old kids' allowances. This is probably a bad thing, and we need to put in new either new user controls or even consider how we allow these games to be marketed. I don't know if that would ever happen. Excuse me?
In-app caps. After you spend $20, it's unlocked or something.
No, we know what the future is. Last week, the Guardian looked at the App Store. 300 new games released Wednesday of last week. Of them, one-third were clones of Flappy Bird, including Tappy Bieber.
You just have to dip your fingers in penicillin after you tap the Bieber.
If ever you wish celebrities could sue.
No, I think that's good. Tap the Bieber. We got Tappy Bieber, Flying Ducky, Flappy Penguin, Easy Flappy Penguin, Flappy the City Flyer, Flying Rainbow Cat, Wander Ghost, Tappy Neon, Flappy Monster, Splashy Bird Ghost, Floppy Spongy, Tappy Duck, Real Bird, Flying Unicorn, and Floating Felix. And I haven't even gone through all of them.
No Flappy Twit yet. Someone should have made a Flappy Twit.
Flappy Twit. Twit. Scrappy Bird, Splashy
that sounds,
Girl.
That sounds like the menu at a legalized brothel in Leap and Reno.
My Fat Flying Dragon, what do you think that is, huh?
There you go.
There you go. Flappy Love, The Adventure of Duck Toy, Happy Bird Light, Birdie Flap, Flap Flappy Troll.
I love the smell of keyword stuffing in the morning.
Other names John Travolta has announced from the Oscars.
And now the incredibly talented Flappy Pyro Bird.
Or as we know him, for all those programmers that listen to this, we are really waiting for Flappy Twit.
No. I'm not waiting for Flappy Twit. I really. How about a floppy flying disc in the land of 8-bit retro game? That's actually the title. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we take a break. We'll come back. Your picks of the week. So fire them up. Fire them up. Our show today brought to you by 99 Designs. It's the world's largest graphic design marketplace. This would be a good time to show the hoodie with our 99 design on it. So we want to do a hoodie. You know, we do these. This is a clever marketing ploy. I admit it, it's a marketing ploy. We do these. You can only get them for a month. There's a limited time. We realize if we just put this stuff on forever, people don't buy them. But if we say you can only buy it for a month, people buy them.
Right.
And so we have these beautiful Twit hoodies. So what we did is we went to 99designs.com. And we said we need a design for a hoodie. We got so many good designs, we bought 5 of them. That's typically what will happen. The designers will look at your – they call it a contest. Look at your contest and then say, you know, submit a design. Let me go to the front page. There are 285,093 designers. They'll look at the contest. There are 2,284 open contests right now. And they will submit design ideas. You look at them. You vet them. You work with them. We ended up buying 5 out of the 40 or 50 that we got. Payouts last month to designers from 99 Designs, $1.9 million.
How much you pay for each one?
It varies. You set the price. The designer decides whether it's worth it to go for the price. It starts as low as $199. How much do we pay for our designs? Do you know? $300 each. Come here. Let's see the this is the one. We're going to make some of the other ones, but this is the hoodie design. Here's Glenn Rubenstein, and he's modeling the hoodie. I loved that design. So we took the 5 designs, we asked you to vote, and we made this one out of the hoodie. Isn't that nice? So those are not on sale yet. Tomorrow. All right. There'll be a Teespring deal?
Yeah.
If you want to get there tomorrow before when it starts, teespring.com/twit. T-E-E-Spring. But that's another story. So, but it's a great mix. We don't, you know, we have some designers in-house that are very good, but it's really a lot of fun to go to 99designs.com and set up a contest and get all these great designs that really kind of gives you a new perspective on your logo, and it can be for a lot of things. Maybe you're a cook and you want a menu design, or you want a landing page for your restaurant. Car wraps, app design. You get a design you love, or your money back. It's very flexible. You just set the price, so you have many concepts, not just proposals, but actual concepts you can choose from. It's very affordable. It's very fast. Here's the deal. Go to 99designs.com/MBW, and you'll get a $99 power pack of services free. Power Pack gives you more designer time and attention. 99 Designs will bold, highlight, and feature your design project in their marketplace. That way you'll get a lot of designs, often twice as many. 99designs.com/MBW. And the process, tell me if I'm right, Lisa, it doesn't cost you anything to go there and set up a contest. You pay once you get a design.
Yeah.
So you set the price for you. So just do it and get some ideas. It's great. 99designs.com/MBW. And we thank 99 Designs for some great designs. They just did our marketing kit. There you go. We use them. We love them. 99designs.com. Our last T-shirt. Actually, our last T-shirt was one of our in-house guys, I think. That was Anthony. Yeah. 99designs.com/MBW. Time for our picks of the week. Alex Lindsay, you're sitting here. Do you have a pick, my friend?
I do. Hold on.
I threw you.
I know.
We're going to find out what Andy's camera of the week, because he finally bought camera one. Camera of the week. But what is your pick of the week, Alex?
So I'm constantly trying to figure out what font to use, exactly how to, what is this going to look like with this font when we're building out bits and pieces? And so a lot of times, you know, you get into the situation where you select the font, then you change it, then you select the font, then you change it, then you select the font, and then you change it. And then you finally just give up and, you know, move on and tell the client that, you know, we went through a lot of stuff and this is what we figured out. So this actually makes it a lot faster. So this is called Ultra Character Map. And, you know, what you can actually do, and I don't remember how much it is, but it's... Ultra Character Map basically allows you to, what is it? Oh, $9.99. Is that right? So great. What it does, all it does is it grabs all your fonts and forget the 3D stuff that it does because it's kind of silly. But what it lets you do is type in custom. So right there where you see that, Chad, I don't know, you can actually type in what you're going to type. You know, so you can type there, you know, I can type Pixel Core or something else, and I can see how it looks in real time in all of the fonts.
So this replaces Apple's kind of built-in.
Yeah, and it's just a lot. I mean, it's just very visual. You can see here, like, I typed in Pixel Core, and I can see... Oops, and I just spilled water.
Oh, that's all right, just water. Sorry. Didn't want to hurt anything.
I wasn't aware that it was there.
You don't want to let that
No, it's running...
Computer.
It's not running... It's
off
computer.
The side, it's fine.
Other directions. Yeah. So anyway, but the... So basically you can see what it's going to look like. You can preview it in all of those fonts at one time. There's a lot of other things you can do with it. You can look specifically at, a certain font and see exactly what it's going to look like. So if I look at them, I just closed it. If you look at the grid, you can look at the grid, and see all of the text that's in that font. So if I grab onto one of these, and so I can look at here, you can see like this is all the characters and glyphs that exist in that font, whether they're mapped or not. So you can really see some of them, you know, are more, you know, complex than others. But you can see what the, you say. Oh, and you can try to figure out where to get those now that you know that they're actually there.
Do you feel like Niki Lauda with the pit crew in a Formula One race? You got all.
I know.
All your guys cleaning
for
up.
For those of you who are listening to the show,
we got major paper towels. We got
people with
ladders.
That was so kindly brought to me, and then I went and just opened my laptop and pushed it all off. And so there's people running around.
Keep it open because we're setting up the camera so we can see this shot. Go ahead, flip it back.
Oh, there we go. So
that's why Chad's up on a ladder behind you right now.
No,
other way. That way. See, he's behind you setting up a camera.
There we go. Oh, okay, so there we go. So anyway. So, there's mass chaos. So anyway, I think that it's a very cool app.
Very nice.
$9.99.
$10. Ultra Character Map. There, finally, after all that.
There we go. See, there's the grid view. You can see me changing fonts here, and then you can also just see me looking at how something like, again, like if I do Pixel Core.
Lovely.
You can see how they all look.
Lovely.
And you can get kind of a
pixely core.
It is the pixely core. So anyway, so that's the app. I like it a lot. I use it every day.
Mr. Rene Ritchie, your pick of the week, sir.
I have two picks. One is an app called Documents 5. It's the latest version of Documents 5.
By the way, I think that's pronounced Tupac. I was explained.
Nice.
No, I'm sorry.
Box.
Go ahead.
I have a big and a small.
Okay. Biggie Smalls. Biggie Smalls, I believe that's pronounced. Biggie Smalls, that's right. It's all 50 right. cents, okay? Just we just want to okay.
Yeah.
Fitty. Yeah.
So one is Documents version 5. Documents by Readle is a really good document editor for iOS, but what they've done that's really interesting with this version is they've done sort of what Google's done with their apps, and that is to get around the lack of inter-app communication of contracts or intents in iOS, they've made all their apps work together. So if you happen to have them all installed, you can hand off a PDF to their PDF app, or you can hand off a scanning if you want to scan something, you can bring it from the scanner into the Documents app. So it means that you have a much more seamless, much more powerful experience if you go in on their ecosystem of apps. And I like that idea very much.
Documents 5.
Yeah, very smart Ukrainian startup company. They've been doing iOS apps for years, Igor and Dennis, and they just keep getting better and better. And they do a lot of stuff with enterprises, so they've been working on enterprise licensing stuff, and it's a very clever workaround to Apple's lack of communications in their apps.
Very good.
The second one is CarPlay, which is Apple's rebranding.
Oh, you know, we didn't talk about that. Let's talk a little bit about that, because that really, we should have been our news stories. Yeah.
The thing about this, it's really cool. CarPlay was sort of a name we joked about back at WWDC, because it sounded so much like bidirectional AirPlay technology.
Right.
And to sort of make Andy's day, the code name for this was Stark, which gives you sort of an indication as to where they're thinking about this technology. And it's really nice because it decouples iOS from the device and lets it take over external displays. In this case, the displays of cars. Now, the car has to be running something first. It has to be running like QNX or Microsoft Embedded, or even, you know, embedded Android or something, because there has to be an infotainment center there. But once that's there, as long as they have their partnership with Apple and all the optimization and the controls are in place, you just go in, you plug in your iPhone, and apps like Phone, like Maps, like Messages, other audio apps like iTunes Radio, iHeartRadio, the podcast app, will all get a unique interface projected onto the display. And the display can send data back and forth to the car. As is usually the case, the things outside of Apple's control can vary. For example, some of the Mercedes have very awkward displays on top of their dashboards. The Ferrari that they were showing off today at the Swiss Auto Show, the Geneva Auto Show, had a nice resistive touchscreen, which is probably very good for leather racing gloves, but not very good for responsiveness. But the system itself seems to be working fantastically well. And it just lets you take everything that's on your personal iPhone and get it into your dashboard with safety precautions, but also with the promise of easy updates from Apple when iOS gets updated, which is almost certainly going to be faster than the typically glacial pace that car companies themselves update their software.
I have to admit at this point, as I think about another, you know, getting another car at some point in time, how my phone interacts with it is probably more important to me than the car performance or mileage or most of the other features in the car, other than maybe how it looks.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah,
they had a great team at Apple working on it.
I think this is also a double big deal. Even when this was just shown off at WWDC, I thought, isn't that interesting? They have demonstrated the ability of iOS to project its interface to a dumber device. And that makes me think that if Apple does do a wearable watch with an actual screen, it doesn't necessarily have to run iOS now. All you have to do is simply, since the host device is going to be an iPhone anyway, it could simply project what it needs into a much more low power, simpler, dumber device.
And the nice thing, too, is that, you know, Apple, unlike Samsung, they will never manufacture their own refrigerators or their own home automation things, nor will they license iOS or any of their operating systems to those companies. But if they can just say your display meets these minimum requirements, then all of a sudden iOS in the car becomes iOS everywhere, or whatever the future right. of iOS is, can start taking over other screens. And I think that sort of lets Apple have their cake and eat it, too, when it comes to the Internet of Things ecosystem.
Well, it'll be different for a device like if they ever go as nuts as Samsung, because it's one thing that you have your phone in your car anyway, but if you have to go upstairs to your bedroom and get your phone out of the charger in order just to get ice out of your refrigerator, that's a problem. That's a friction point.
But I would love iOS on my Canon camera, for example, and Apple will never do it. But if one day there are mythical cameras that can be projected onto, I would love that too.
Yeah. I'm gonna save you for the best for last, Andy, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to – we were talking on the radio show the other day about the sound effects of Dark Castle. Remember that? Well, it turns out Z-Sculpt has been working for some time on a Dark Castle clone. Return to Dark Castle is on the Mac App Store for $10. If you played this classic game, as I'm sure many of you did, in black and white on your old Mac Classic, you'll recognize the sound. Whoa. But now in glorious 3D.
That is the sound of my at an 8:30 a.m. lecture with only 2 hours of sleep.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what? So you know what's funny is that to really date me. I've never actually seen Dark Castle.
You haven't?
But I have. But what that really reminds me of is Aztec. Does anyone remember Aztec?
No, yes. I don't. Was that a Mac
Apple
game?
It was an Apple II.
Apple II. I'm sure this was influenced by that.
Yeah,
for
it looks
sure.
Very much like Aztec.
Yeah.
Reminds me of Beer Run too.
Yeah. Well. But this is Dark Castle. $10. Return to Dark Castle. It's got more levels. All the classic levels. It's a lot of fun. And my quest has ended. Now it is time, ladies and gentlemen. We know Andy Inaka was in the market for a brand new camera, but we don't know which camera he chose because he decided to play it coy last week. But now he is going to reveal all. Andy, your pick of the week.
Coy? I wasn't being coy. No, it's just that at the time I had ordered it, it arrived that morning, and just in case, you hate to be enthusiastic about something that still smells like packaging peanuts, and then next week you're like, I wish I hadn't recommended this because now I realize it stinks. But yes, this is lovely. This is the Olympus OMD OMD EM1, which is Olympus's attempt to say, well, we were one of the two companies that started off making Micro Four Thirds format sensor cameras. Now we're going to make one that is absolutely unabashedly, no questions asked, a professional style camera. And I absolutely love it. It is absolutely the camera that I was hoping for, because buying a camera is like, it's a very idiosyncratic sort of choice. It really has to be the camera for you and the way that you shoot and what you want. I had a nice budget to work with. This is not a cheap camera. The body alone is about $1,400. This lens is a made to pro specifications lens, and it's about another $1,000. So this really is as expensive as a nice, not pro level, but a nice Nikon with a very nice lens too. But the problem with that is that SLRs are just so big and they're so heavy. They take up so much space. This is a mirrorless compact, which means that it doesn't need to have a mirror box in it, doesn't need to have a prism in it. And for that reason, and because the sensor is smaller, the lenses can be smaller as well. The reason why I started off on Micro Four Thirds to begin with was the number of times when I had to leave my Nikon D200 at home, even though I was going on, I was going to be in Europe for 10 days, but I just knew that I can't have this big SLR around my neck everywhere I go and everything I do. And with these compact mirrorless cameras, even if you don't get an Olympus, they're great because you really can break them down and stick them in your shoulder bag, and it doesn't look like you're carrying, $2,000 worth of camera equipment there. The only worry that I had about it is that Micro Four Thirds sensors are not as they don't handle high ISOs, high light sensitivity modes as well as APS-C cameras, which is what you get, with the Sonys, with the Fujis, with that sort of stuff. But this has a killer feature that sort of makes up for all of that. This has in-body five-axis stabilization. So no matter what you're doing when you're holding this camera, it can really absolutely negate that. And it works with any lens that you work it with. And so I went out shooting twice so far with it. And the first night I had it out was just after sunset, like as night is falling, like in Boston. And this is exactly the right sort of situation for that sort of thing. Normally,
gorgeous. Wow, yeah, that's beautiful.
And if you can, I don't know if you can zoom in, but that is absolutely tack sharp. And that is like a third of a second, a fifth of a second. So such a long exposure that there's just no frickin' way that you'll get a sharp image on any other camera. So yes, this doesn't work as well at high ISOs than a Fuji or a Sony does. But the thing is that this will give you as sharp an image at ISO. ISO 1600 or 800 as you would get from a Fuji or a Sony that's working at 3200. And if you had a Fuji or a Sony, you'd have to bump it up to 3200 to get that high shutter speed in order to freeze the frame. Other than that, though, I mean, it's weatherproof. The lens is weatherproof too. You can get it in the rain. You don't have to really care about it. It's really it's like made like an AK-47. It's so solidly built. And on top of everything else, though, I just love all of the thought that went into this tactile interface. I actually thought that the lens was broken because it couldn't autofocus. And then I actually, you know, read the manual and discovered that it's normally in autofocus mode. But if you want to get into manual focus, you take this ring and you snip, pull it down, and now you're manually focusing. And so, you can do all of this with the thumb dials, with this control. So you can just never have to take it away from your face at all because it's all completely tactile. Every knob, every dial, every function button, and there are a whole bunch of function buttons all over this place, can be reassigned. So within, if there's, on day three, I realized that I really hate that every time, I really hate that the rear button is, the rear wheel is make is adjusting white balance. I don't adjust white balance that much. Very easy for me to reassign it to something else or turn it off entirely. I mean, the bottom line is that I do, whether my photography is any good or not, it's something I have a lot of fun with. And I really drive myself nuts when I can't get the shot that I really, really want. And so that's why it's worth it to me to have a really good lens and a really good camera. And this is just so much fun to shoot with that I'm not a gun enthusiast, but I understand what some people, friends of mine who shoot guns, say when they say that this is just a fun thing to shoot
with. It's just a gorgeous machine.
It's just, it's comfortable to hold. You feel as though everything is exactly where you want it to be. I'm just in love with this camera. So,
Lisa and I bought twin EM fives for our trip to Italy, and we were so happy. And of course, we shared those Micro Four Thirds lenses. And then I reviewed this on Before You Buy, and it has some. They've really, the M1 is, it's a little confusing. It's better than the M5, and they've learned a lot from the EM5, and it's even better. It's just a wonderful.
This is, I mean, this is. I was really tempted by the Fuji is doing some great stuff with mirrorless compacts too. It's not the same lens system and sensor system, but they're doing some great things too. The reason why I wasn't terribly tempted by their new SLR style camera was that this really does feel like a company that's been doing this for years now, and they know exactly what they're doing. And this is like their fourth. This is the fourth generation piece of hardware that they've built. Whereas Fuji, I think they're still on their first or second generation line of thought. They haven't really worked out all of the design kinks in terms of making a really fun to shoot camera, and Olympus really, really has done that. Like I said, I can't, if you shoot the way that I shoot, you have the same relationship with cameras that I do. This is the Andy Anatko model camera, really.
Yeah, I agree.
It's like I can't imagine designing something that's as good as that. And finally, I mean, a couple of years ago, I thought that I was going to be buying a new camera because I had the money set aside. It was really time for an upgrade because, again, that Nikon D200 I had was just really, really old by camera standards. And it was time for an upgrade. I just didn't find anything that really seemed as though this is something that I'm going to be able to use for the next 3 or 4 or 5 years. It doesn't feel like a really, really modern camera. So I bought a really cheap Panasonic Micro Four Thirds camera. And now the cool thing is that I can take the really nice lens I bought for this will also work on that little pocket size Panasonic.
Vice versa, yeah.
Exactly. And I can have now when I travel, I can actually now have two camera bodies on me at the same time because that Panasonic is about the size of a big deck of cards. There's just absolutely no size to it whatsoever. So that's another benefit for it. But like I said, not a cheap item, but absolutely the right choice for me.
Micro Four Thirds is the only system where it's the lenses are compatible cross-manufacturer, and there is a huge range of very good lenses.
Panasonic and Olympus both decided on get on board at the same time. There are a couple other minor manufacturers who are doing Micro Four
Fuji.
Thirds. I think they have their new cameras at least have their own proprietary lens mod, as far as I know, because like I said, that was part of the decision for me. It has a larger sensor and all that sort of stuff. But the other factor is that it seems as though when a company announces they're coming out with a really, really great lens, it's Micro Four Thirds first, and then they drift it down to the other formats later, because there are a few truisms about cameras that have been around for the past 40 or 50 years. And one of them is that, you know, if you can spend 90% of your money on a lens and buy a cheap body, you'll get better pictures than if you buy 90% of your money on a lens on a body than buy a cheap lens. And so I'm just convinced that if next year I want to get a different kind of a zoom, that there's going to be Olympus has a really good plan for more pro lenses, other manufacturers, really good pro lenses. So this is going to, I feel as though this is going to make me happy for at least the next 5 years.
Yeah, I think you made an excellent choice. Really love those cameras. Thank you, Andy. Our slots machine is available in better casinos everywhere. Don't forget to bet one Alex if you really want to win.
So awesome.
I don't know who did that, but they did it fast. Thank you very much. And we did neglect to mention a big story that broke earlier today. It was rumored yesterday that Apple CFO Peter Oppenheimer is leaving after 18 years. He's the guy you'd hear on those analyst calls. He's taking a job at Goldman Sachs. I think it's safe to say he's decided to cash in.
He's retiring to spend more money. More time with his money.
He
also wants to get into philanthropy. He wants to get his pilot's license, and he wants to move.
It's got to be hard work to be Apple's CFO.
And he's being replaced by Luca Mastri, who has a fantastic name.
Wow, that's did you see that view down? That he oversaw, it went from $8 billion to $171 billion.
That's pretty big growth. Yeah.
No money left to conquer.
And Luca Mastri came to Apple about a year ago from Xerox. He was CFO over at Xerox, so I think he probably knows how to build $8 billion companies into $1 billion.
He was on the last conference call, too, which makes a lot of sense now.
Ah, was he? Ah, yeah. Interesting. Okay.
His first appearance.
New CFO. Apple's apparently not known about this for a while, and that's why they were grooming Mastri. Hey, thank you, everybody. That's it for Mac Break Weekly for this week. We do it every Tuesday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1900 UTC. Please join us for the live broadcast at twit.tv. But you don't ever have to worry. You'll never miss an episode because we make audio and video available always after the fact at our website, twit.tv/MBW, and everywhere that podcasts are aggregated. So if you subscribe to us on iTunes, you'll get each and every episode the minute it comes out. Thanks to Andy Iannocco for being here, Chicago Sun-Times, as always. Renee Ritchie from iMore.com and Mobile Nations, great to have you. And Alex Lindsay from the Pixel Corner, thanks again for pitching in on Twit. You were great.
My pleasure.
It was a lot of fun.
It was fun to be there.
We'll see you next time. Now get back to work because break time is over.